the proportion of 10-year-olds who cannot read a simple text or do basic math can be as high as 90% in low-income countries. And that's what we're calling the global learning crisis.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips.
Instead of being the great enablers, education is fast becoming a great divider. The rich have access to the best resources, schools and universities, leading to the best jobs, while the poor, especially girls, face huge obstacles to getting the qualifications that could change their lives.
In September 2022, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres convened the Transforming Education Summit by telling the attendees from around the world that education is beset by inequalities and struggling to adjust to the needs of the 21st century. Their task? To tackle the global learning crisis by transforming their education systems. So what commitments were made? And how much progress has there been since 2022? And what are the challenges ahead? Robert Jenkins is the Global Director of Education and Adolescent Development at UNICEF, and he joins me now to answer some of those questions. Robert, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Robert, take us back to September 2022. Why was this summit convened? Whose idea was it? Who was driving it?
It's actually not a period, I don't think, in any of our lives we want to go back to in the sense of the COVID part of it, with school closures, et cetera. But September 2022 was a watershed moment for the global education community and the sector. By the UN Secretary General actually convened the Transforming Education Summit, as you had also referred to. Of course, it was decided for that summit to take place before the pandemic had struck, if you'd like. And so it turned out that actually the summit tone and urgency and content changed quite a bit because, as you very well know, at that time in 2022, we were just emerging out of the absolutely largest school closures globally at any point in history. We had over 90% of the world learners at the height of that out of school. So it definitely changed the tone, increased urgency, focused attention on the importance of learning. And that indeed was the nature of the conversation.
As you say, it was a high-stakes summit to start with, became even higher stakes. So what was the outcome at the time?
There was a meeting of minds, if you'd like, of whether it's big numbers, 133 member states were present. We had 65 heads of state with all international organizations, or the vast majority represented at very senior levels. So right people in the room at the time, all recommitting to transforming education, the title of the summit, recognizing how important it was that we address long-standing challenges in the education sector. That's one thing, Tim, I want to just highlight. It's, of course, the school closures as a result of the pandemic exacerbated the challenges that related to the learning crisis. But the learning crisis was very much in existence and a global challenge prior to the school closures of COVID. So the summit's discussions were around urgency for action around the world to reach marginalized children, reach those who are being left behind, transform education systems. So there was an urgent action because of the crisis, but also we need to look at the broader systemic challenges that the education sector were facing that also need to be addressed. Overall, the commitments were very impressive. A lot of best practices were shared, a lot of renewed commitments of world leaders. And now, 2 years on, we're very much engaging with countries around the world to continue to translate those commitments into action.
And when those commitments are being made, you're in the room representing UNICEF. What is UNICEF's remit in this context? How does that translate into day-to-day actions?
We're part of the UN family, and so we work very, very closely with our sister agency, UNESCO, but also the World Bank and other international financial institutions, international non-governmental organizations. So we work very much in partnership. But UNICEF's specific comparative advantage is our operational capacity. So Tim, the vast majority of UNICEF staff work in program countries, as we're calling, about 145 countries we have active programs in. And about, say, in the education sector, as you were mentioning, the Global Director of Education, the education sector, over 95% of our staff are indeed at country level, day-to-day working with ministries of education, with partners in those countries to accelerate progress in education. at the summit, we come with an awareness and experience and lessons drawn from this operational footprint that we have in program countries. That's our particular strength.
Before we look at progress, let's have a look at some of the commitments that were made. And a lot of the headline commitments were around foundational learning. Can you explain to me what foundational learning is, what standards it represents, why it is so important?
Let me just take a step back. And if we think of a child's learning journey, I think there are three key moments. Every day is important. We're all learning, actually, lifelong learning. But there are three key moments in a child's learning journey that I just want to highlight. One is the day they start school. When you start school, you need to be, quote unquote, school ready. And there are certain behaviors, certain skills, certain attributes a child displays that enables them to be successful right as they walk into school. The best way to achieve that is early childhood education, attending formal preschool, if you'd like. Then we move to a second key stage, which is learning how to read and write and basic numeracy. That's what foundational learning refers to.
Right.
It's understanding simple text in your mother tongue, but also being able to write and basic numeracy, like simple single-digit math. That's foundational. And it's foundational, Tim, in the sense that as you continue on your learning journey, in order to be successful as you move up to higher grades, you need to be able to read and write and do base math to be successful in those other subjects and continue. So early childhood education, Joel will be school ready. Foundational learning, often around 10, 11, 12 years old, so that then you continue to the third transition, which is ultimately graduating out of your education and transitioning to adulthood. So those are the three key transitions. That middle transition, foundational learning, is absolutely critical. And we do recognize that's a marginalized children. It's a point where they often face increasing vulnerability. And ultimately, then, it's one of the reasons why we see children dropping out of school is because they weren't able to successfully acquire those basic foundational learning skills.
What can we generalize about the state of foundational learning today in low, middle-income countries?
The proportion of 10-year-olds who cannot read a simple text or do basic math, it is about 2 out of every 3 10-year-olds globally. It can be as high as 90% in low-income countries. We have up to 90% in low-income countries of children at 10 not successfully meeting that key transition, I'm calling it, from foundational learning to continuing along their learning journey. That's what we're calling the global learning crisis.
Now, at the summit, you had 130 plus countries, which must have been at many stages of economic development. So is this push to improve foundational learning, is it focused on particular crisis situations that you identify, or is it something that is designed to work across the board?
I think the answer is across the board, meaning all countries need to continue to focus. High income, middle income, low income countries affected by crisis, a focus on foundational learning is critical. Now, we do see huge differences in terms of percentage of children that acquire foundational learning. High income countries, it tends to be almost all children are able to read and write by that time. And then in low-income countries or fragile countries, it's the exact opposite. The other issue, Tim, is within countries, we see quite a range. And that's characteristics as, for example, girls that face gender-related barriers to continue along their learning journey within school or access school. We have other marginalized groups, such as those children living in remote locations, or their mother tongue is not offered in the school system. And we also have children living in humanitarian crisis-affected, conflict-affected, natural disasters, etc. Those children are disproportionately affected by the learning crisis, meaning have an increased chance of not being able to read and write at that critical moment. And so at the summit, UNICEF was strongly advocating for an increased focus on foundational learning, working very closely alongside many global partners, but also encouraging those global decision makers and national level too to focus on marginalized children to address the growing disparities that exist in the education sector. Those are our main messages.
You also have targets for digital learning. There are many regions around the world where schools can't even reliably access electricity. Is this a priority?
Tim, it absolutely is a priority. And for digital learning, I think a general consensus that digital learning can be the great equalizer, and we have amazing examples of how it truly has transformed children's learning. However, the opposite is true in the sense that it can also be another modality which results in growing disparities, because children who do not have access to the internet or do not have a device or in a school system that does not have the capability to provide world-class digital learning can have increased tendency to be left behind. What's absolutely critical is that we leverage the amazing power of digital tools and what it can offer, but we enable that to reach the most marginalized and indeed be transformative so that all children can benefit. And the current trends, Tim, are negative on that front, meaning we see growing disparities around the world, including in access to digital learning. And so a big push needs to be in this regard, enabling the most marginalized children to benefit from these very powerful and influential tools.
There was one further commitment I wanted to ask you about, and that is greening education. What does this mean? What knowledge and skills do you foresee being taught here? Why is it important to teach them?
Well, every year we have about 40 million children that have their education disrupted because of climate-related disasters. So we all see it in the news every day. Marginalized children, adolescents, and climate hotspots, particularly girls, are disproportionately affected by extreme and unpredictable weather. And so again, unless we are proactively enabling fragile education systems, but also marginalized children living within low-income and crisis-affected countries, this will be another cause of increasing disparities. Now, the education sector has an enormous amount that it can offer to this discussion and this challenge, including by mainstreaming climate into education systems, by greening learning opportunities, by rolling out green skilling programs for adolescents, by making schools greener and safer with disaster risk reduction strategies. I think education systems can contribute an enormous amount to this challenge of climate change. And that's indeed happening in many countries, has to happen in more countries, and has to happen at increasing scale. But we have some very exciting developments.
Robert, these are important commitments, and it's great to see them being made, but none of the success, none of the follow-through can happen without money, can it? How much of this problem is finding the budget for education when every government has competing demands?
Well, I'm glad you raised it, Tim, and it's a really important part of the solution. We definitely need to ensure sufficient resources enabled for children to learn and for education systems to be transformed. When we talk about resources, we normally bring up three key issues. One is absolute amount of funding needs to be provided, public resources, predominantly from governments, but also from actors like ourselves, international organizations, and communities. So you need an absolute amount of funding, and there is a huge difference and divide between the amount of funding for education in low-income countries compared to high-income countries. So there is an absolute amount, governments meeting the benchmark, if you'd like, of 20% of their budgets being provided for education. The second is how that money is used, the effectiveness of the use of those resources. And that comes back to things like the percentage or proportion of funding that is allocated to foundational learning or primary school, the amount that is used to ensure teachers are paid a standard of living that enables them to perform to their capacity, etc. Then the third dimension is equity. How equitable are resources being used in a country? And we see a wide range of that, Tim, including in some countries, the poorest 20% of children can receive less than their fair share, meaning far less than the 20% of the public resources allocated to education. Some countries have four or five times more money going to the top 20% of children in terms of income compared to the poorest 20%. So we've got overall amount of resources for education. We have how it's being used and the effectiveness of those resources, and also how equitable. All three have very interesting dimensions to them, all need to move on an accelerated basis in order for us to transform education. We have some amazing examples of countries that are working on all three of those dimensions of funding. And then we also have other countries that need to do a lot more.
How many countries need to do a lot more? How close are we to that 20%?
it has not been a positive period post the pandemic for overall global education resources. Mm. The funding for education globally, I'm talking about, like take all sources of funding in total, has declined despite all the issues we've been talking about of the rising challenges. So there has been a decline of ODA, official development assistance, to education, something that's very worrying. I work in the education sector, so of course I'm biased on education resources. Mm-hmm. So I do recognize there are other fiscal pressures, inflation, cost of living, and responding to climate change, disasters, etc. However, I think it is fair to say that if we do not invest sufficiently in education and in learning, it will have medium to long-term impact on the growth and future of society. We are worried about the declining overall enveloped education, including the declining development assistance to education. From domestic, about two-fifths, about 40% of countries meet the 15% government expenditure threshold of the percentage of funding from their budgets that go to education. And that's worrying, Tim, because it will limit the ability to transform education systems and also reach all children if we just isn't a minimum absolute amount of resources.
Is closing that gap all down to government spending? There has been some interesting research on where private investment in education, in a limited sense, can provide some of that education shortfall that we're experiencing.
So I do think this is a moment in time where we need to be crowding in all other potential stakeholders, foundations, private sector investments, and others in order to respond to this global learning crisis. Still, the bulk of funding for education will come from governments in low-income countries and high-income countries alike, but innovative financing methods, including new ways of making other stakeholders interested in investing in education, will be absolutely critical. So government and proportion of funding from government's budgets around the world, I'm talking about, including the low-income countries' budgets, will still be the bulk of resources to education. But as you've mentioning, new and innovative public-private partnerships and innovative financing to crowd in additional sources of funding, we're seeing some really exciting developments in that space, and that will definitely be part of the solution.
So let's have a look at some of the progress since 2022 and some of the reasons why countries are making progress. You recently reported a survey that you did of 94 countries checking the early progress on these targets. How many countries are taking positive action as a result of this summit?
It depends on the area of follow-up. So because we've been monitoring actions around foundational learning, around girls' education, around early childhood education, etc. But let me just give a couple of snapshots. We have over 75% of the countries reported, so of those 94 countries, that are taking concrete action to promote digital learning and transform education with digital tools. And we also have over nearly 75% that are promoting increased access to inclusive, quality, and safe learning. So both critical issues, and we were really pleased with the progress and the number of countries that we see concrete action. For countries where over 10% of primary school age children are out of school, which, Tim, I've early been talking about the learning crisis and overall the challenge of foundational learning, but we can't also lose sight of the fact that we continue to have significant numbers of children that are out of school, including primary school age children. In the countries where 10% of the primary school age children population are out of school, 4 of 5 of those countries are taking very significant steps to advance access and bridge, if you'd like, out-of-school children back into learning opportunities. So overall, again, we'd like all countries to be taking action across these areas, but overall, we've got some very significant numbers of countries acting and some great examples of really transformative action.
So far, we've been talking about big targets and big initiatives in the broadest sense. But how hard is it to take these commitments that we've been talking about, make them into achievable policies, achievable targets that make sense to individual schools, to individual policymakers? Is that a process that you can help with?
Well, that would be one of UNICEF's key strengths. And it's back to the beginning of our conversation where our comparative advantage is our operational presence across the 145 countries in which we work and on a day-to-day basis, engaging with ministries of education and other education actors to do just that. Take these global commitments from, for example, the Transforming Education Summit, and then integrate those commitments into the national planning processes, national system strengthening efforts, into the policy and planning dialogues that are taking place at country level. In the end, then, Tim, to translate into concrete, measurable changes within the school system itself and in a child's learning experience. One of the key issues there requires alignment, and is the word, or coherence, in that the policies and plans that are being put in place at national level are aligned and translated throughout the education system that result in tangible changes right down to the seven-year-old in grade two that is now has an improved learning environment. And that's what we call often system strengthening and ensuring their incentives and support are in place to indeed to translate. So for one is translate global commitments into these processes at national level, and then to translate those policy changes and plans into tangible action at scale within every country.
You said just now that there were some great examples of success. Are there any that stick out to you?
We are monitoring that very, very closely, and we engage around the world. You've got countries like, for example, Sierra Leone, which has adopted a policy of radical inclusion, which really has informed education policy, but other policies too, that very proactively addresses barriers that marginalized children are facing, gender-related barriers, but also other barriers that children face to enable them to access schools throughout Sierra Leone, but also improving the quality of their learning experience. Back to greening education, in Cambodia, for example, they've adopted a life skills approach that integrates climate action right into the national curriculum so that as children are learning in the school system, they're learning about climate action. We've got amazing examples of digital learning, including with the Learning Passport, a partnership between UNICEF and Microsoft, which is now reaching over 7 million children. That's just an initiative that started in 2019. So we're 4 years into it, and now we're 7 million. So over 45 countries. That's a tool that's showing great promise also in enabling the transformation of education systems, but enabling children to learn. So we have these best practices that are at scale, that are indeed leading to transformation, that are showing great promise. The challenge is, how do we take these across all countries, recognizing the global scale of the learning crisis?
When we talk about best practices, it reminds me of an interview we did with Rachel Glenister in 2023 about the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, GEAP. Their work in producing a report that identifies the best buys for education is the way they phrase it. What research tells us are particular policies or innovations that have the best value for money. Does this sort of evidence base feed into your work?
It does. And we work really, really closely with the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, including Rachel and all the very prominent, impressive members of that panel. Mm. And I think it's fair to say the education sector has moved a long ways in generating, but also appreciating evidence of best practices and lessons learned and incorporating that into policy and planning processes. It's critically important because, let's just be honest, and when funds are limited, it's ever more important for us to kind of maximize the impact of every dollar and every effort. The Smart Buys report that they issue, we leverage to its maximum to inform those national planning and policy dialogues that we're very much involved in the rolling out process. Just last month, actually, we organized a global webinar of all our UNICEF colleagues around the world, education colleagues, on this report, just so that they're also informed of the latest hot off the press thinking of what works. Mm-hmm. And that informs then their daily dialogue with ministries and ministers of education and translates that into action at country level.
Education is very different in different places and faces different challenges. You talked about taking best practice and implementing it in other contexts. How much of what you do is about that, and how much of that is putting systems in place where improvements can be made bottom up?
Well, I do think education does require, of all sectors, it's critically important that the changes that are being introduced and the transformation that is being implemented around the world to enable children to achieve learning outcomes and be a sense of safety and psychosocial well-being and a holistic approach in education systems, Tim, it's critical that an engagement process is inbuilt in that change process so that children, their parents, teachers, school administrators, and ultimately policymakers are all very much in the driver's seat and engaged in that change and transformation process. Education in particular is of such vital importance to a child's life, but also to parents' aspiration for their children. And also it's the teachers and school administrators, et cetera, that are obviously the most informed on what's possible and what are the challenges they face. So embedded in any good policy and planning process and implementation of a change process and large-scale programs is engagement and ownership and empowerment, if you'd like, of those key stakeholders. But recognizing that, leadership also, Tim, is critical. And leadership, particularly at country level, which we see around the world with many dynamic ministers of education that are making bold changes. All changes, if you like, start and transformation start with leaders. And we have some amazing, impressive ones that are doing just that.
Robert, we focused very much on the problems of implementing policy, putting what we know into practice and finding the funding and the commitment and the systems to do that. Are there still knowledge gaps? Are there areas where you would like to see more research into what works? And perhaps does academic research overfocus on some areas of education and maybe not look at others?
Maybe the two things that jump to mind in terms of blue water, if you'd like, that we need to paddle into or areas that require greater thinking, I would say we do need at-scale change. So research and evidence and best practices that show change that will have an impact on percentages of children going from 20% to 50%, 50% to 80%. That's critically important. I think we have to be careful not to go down that trap of piloting in small scale and research of only small numbers of schools or small numbers of children when we have an at-scale crisis. So that's one. I think the second is we need to continue to research the impact of global tools like global digital learning tools and others' developments. How can we leverage these innovative, cutting-edge learning tools for marginalized children, particularly marginalized children living in low-income countries or affected by crisis? How can they benefit from such innovations? I think we run the risk of leaving children behind if we're not proactive. So I think a research agenda to continue to document the best practices and the lessons learned to enable all children to benefit from these innovations is also critically important.
Robert, we started off talking about the impact that COVID has had on education around the world. In the future, do you think that the pandemic will be seen as a time at which education was set back in the long term? Or is there a possibility that it was a time at which policymakers reevaluated what education was for and what they could do with it?
I tend to be optimistic, Tim. And while globally the numbers are daunting, I think there was an increased appreciation of the importance role that schools play in a child's life and a community life. I think it was a broader appreciation beyond learning, including the important role schools play in a sense of safety, midday meals and nutrition, health services, water and sanitation. I also think that it has highlighted longstanding disparities and marginalization that were exacerbated when schools were closed. And now as we are transforming education systems and working with governments around the world, I think the commitment to address those longstanding disparities has been renewed. So I do think there have been positive things that came out from that very tumultuous time. I think also there is an appreciation that every individual child's learning journey is unique, and we recognize that the differential impact that school closures had on various children, and therefore the need to also meet every child where they are with their learning, provide holistic support to enable them to be successful. I think that realization also was further cemented, and that informs the way we work around the world now.
Robert Jenkins, thank you very much.
Thanks again for having me, Tim. Really appreciate it.
There is a UNESCO World Education blog that Robert wrote, which is called More Than 1 Year After the Transforming Education Summit, What Progress Have Countries Made? That was published on the 15th of February 2024. If you look at the UNICEF website, you can find an article on tracking progress on foundational learning findings from the Rapid 2023 analysis. That was from August 2023. There will soon be a Vox Devlet. I can announce it now, on improving learning outcomes. So that will look at a lot of the research that we have been discussing today. And I did reference that Vox Dev talk from last year, Policies to Improve Global Learning, with Rachel Glenister, from July 2023. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our best episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org.